matters of life. At points, he wanted to trick Jesus.
That's right.
And show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying, this was the good man, this was the great man. Because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. At times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, or down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right, that's right.
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
If I help my neighbor, what will happen to me? I think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had it right. That's the question that we often ask ourselves and even one another. What's at stake for us if we risk helping our neighbor? And yet MLK also had it right that that's probably the wrong question. Indeed, it is most certainly the wrong question. The question is, if I do not help my neighbor, what will happen to my neighbor? The lawyer that asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" was probably asking a question of category. How will I know which people are my neighbors and which people I can exclude? How can I draw boundaries that will let in the right people, my neighbors, and keep out the wrong people, those who are not my neighbor? He figured that Jesus would give him a good and clear answer about this. But Jesus' answer took the question and turned it on its head, as Jesus' answers often did. He said, "It's not a question of being so much as it's a question of doing." Neighbor is as neighbor does, says Jesus. He tells a story about a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho who's beaten half dead and left there in the ditch to die. The question isn't, is the beaten man my neighbor? The question is, will I be a neighbor to the man who's been left in the ditch? And so here comes a priest. The lawyer, probably listening, is asking himself, here we go. Maybe I can learn the category of neighbor and non-neighbor. Jesus is using categories. I've got Israelite in the ditch. I've got priest on the way. And the priest walks by. Here comes Levite. The lawyer, again, probably thinking, here's category of person. That will tell me something. The Levite walks by, and here comes Samaritan. And the lawyer, who knew the difference between Israelite and Samaritan, probably was thinking to himself, the time is gone. Samaritans are definitely not my neighbor. The story must be longer than I thought it would be. And Samaritan stops and cares for the victim, binds the wounds, puts him on his beast, takes him to lodging, offers more help. Which one was a neighbor? The one who showed him mercy. Go and do likewise. Neighbor is as neighbor does, says Jesus. Yes, there is risk when we reach out and help our neighbors. Yes, there is risk when we define neighbor more broadly than perhaps we want to. When we go beyond our next door neighbor, when we go beyond our local community, when we go beyond our faith community, when we go beyond our national borders, there is risk in serving the neighbor. But the call of faith that we receive through this story and through Jesus' ministry is that we are called to be those people who reach out, who receive our neighbors, who offer them succor, who offer them compassion, who offer them our presence. Many of you may already know that Martin Luther King Jr. gave that sermon one day before he was gunned down by somebody who did not envision living the world as the kind of neighborhood that Jesus was talking about. King was in Memphis for the sanitation workers' strike. He was urging folks to see those suffering workers as their neighbors. And then on a motel balcony, He was gunned down by people who were afraid of what would happen if people who were unlike them all of a sudden had rights, all of a sudden could organize, if people who were unlike them had access to goods and services and places and spaces. What kind of neighborhood would that be? King knew that there were folks who envisioned a closed neighborhood, a gated neighborhood, a national neighborhood that had firm boundaries and excluded those who were unlike the majority. And yet he continued, even at personal risk. Jesus asks us, will we be neighbors? He asks us to consider not what categories of people we can include and exclude, but will we be neighbors? Will we reach out to those who are being oppressed, to those who hunger and thirst, to those who are being excluded, to those who are on the other side of fences and walls and borders, to those who do not look like us, who do not speak like us? Will we be neighbors? It's not an easy question, I'll admit. And I don't think it has an easy answer. The answer requires faith and commitment. I've spent the last 3 weeks sojourning. Was in India, in southern India, going from place to place, representing our congregation. I was at many of our global ministry partner ministries, sharing with them that our congregation is a global mission partner. I visited a leper village. I visited an AIDS hospital. I visited several orphanages. I visited half a dozen schools. I preached 2 funerals and 2 weddings. I preached to 3 congregations for Sunday morning worship. I led several Bible studies, and each and every place that I went, I was the sojourner. I was the different one. I was the one whose language was foreign. And I was welcomed each and every time. The people I encountered were being neighbors. And I've got to tell you, when you go into a new village in a new place, even I, who've done this in dozens of other countries, you're always a little bit nervous. Will people welcome me? How will I be received? What will it mean to encounter a new group of people? Each and every time, people were incredibly welcoming. So much so that I learned so much about the flavor of southern India. I met and encountered and spent time with Muslims, with Hindus, and yes, with the Christian minority in southern India. Only about 3 or 4% in India are actually Christians. And they were welcoming, and they were faithful. And I learned about their food, and I learned about their language, and I learned about the beauty of their culture. I was sojourning in their land, and they brought me in, and they offered me food, and they offered me welcome. They offered me friendship. They were doing the work of being neighbors. It made me ask myself, how will I do the work of being neighbor in my own place and to people who come from other places? I'd like to say that any time that I travel, I always go with only the good gospel heart. But I also always go to buy souvenirs. I know that in India there are beautiful fabrics, silks and designs and all kinds of elegant material. And so I took a pocket full of money, much to Susan's chagrin, and I decided that I was going to look everywhere I could, and I was going to buy all of these wonderful fabrics and spend all of our money. And I went around southern India, and lo and behold, I found beautiful fabric after 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 beautiful fabric. Now, lest you sit there in this pre-offering moment and say, we pay that guy way too much. I want you to know that every place I went as a stranger, I was sat down, I was given a fresh flower lei around the neck, and I was given a gift of one of these shawls. I never spent a dime on those beautiful fabrics. People who did not know me, people who did not understand me sometimes, people who had not met me, decided to reach out and offer love and care to me. How will we, as people of God living in this United States, be those who understand that boundaries are meant to be crossed, neighbors are meant to be loved and served, people are meant to be welcomed? And what will it mean for us here in our own neighborhood to see those who are suffering most and reach out to them as well? One of the places I went in Vellore in southern India was the Christian Medical College and Hospital. Now, what you need to know about CMC, Christian Medical College and Hospital, is that it is the largest mission hospital in all of southern India. It serves about 8,000 patients per day. It has 7 campuses, and everyone gets top-notch medical service regardless of their ability to pay. Liver transplants, bone marrow transplants, limb transplants, heart transplants, cancer treatment, dialysis, diabetes treatment, you name it, they do it there. Some of the top doctors in the world, some of the best technology in the world, everyone is cared for. Why? Because it's a Christian mission. And the people who run that Christian mission understand that Jesus said, don't ask who's my neighbor, get out there and be a neighbor. The person in charge of public relations for this huge hospital system was giving me a tour of the hospital, and he told me about its beginnings. I was very interested to hear about that because I thought to myself, by the time you're a 7-campus hospital with 8,000 patients a day and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and more than 1,000 doctors and a medical school and a nursing school and a pharmaceutical school and all of the rest, you must have had some serious investment in your beginning. And he told me this story. In 1890, in a village not far from here, the daughter of an American missionary was here in India visiting her father. Her name was Ida Scudder. And while she was at her father's house, her father was in a nearby village taking care of patients. He was a doctor. And a knock came at the door, and Ida answered the door, and it was a man from the village, and he said, please come, my daughter's in childbirth, and she's going to die if someone doesn't help her. And Ida immediately said, my dad's the local doctor, you know that, he'll be here soon, and he'll come to help. And the man said, no, our culture does not allow a man to touch a woman in childbirth, you've got to come. And Ida knew she couldn't come, she had no medical training, and the man went away. A little later, another knock came at the door. She wondered if it was the same man come again, and she was so forlorn because her father wasn't back, and the man wouldn't allow her father to treat the daughter. And another man was at the door, and he said, please come, my wife is in labor with the child. It's difficult, there's bleeding, I don't know what to do. If you come and help, she'll live. Ida said, my father is a doctor, he's coming. And he said, no, you know our culture won't allow for a man to touch a woman in childbirth. A few hours later, a third knock, a third man, same story. Later, Ida heard that each of those women and their babies died in childbirth. Ida writes in her journal that God came to her that night and in essence said to her, what will you do to care for people in this situation? Ida decided to respond to God's call to be a neighbor by going back to the United States, to Philadelphia. This is 1890, remember, and to go to medical school. You can easily count on your fingers how many women were entering medical school at that time in that place. She studied diligently, she became a doctor, she returned to southern India, and in one house with one bed in one room, she began Christian Medical College and Hospital. She decided that she was going to be there and serve as a neighbor so that people would receive the health care that they needed, and especially women. And she knew that it wasn't enough to just start with herself. She knew that she had to do something that would change lives in an ongoing fashion. And so she began to train southern Indian women, poor village women, to be doctors. She reached out to the government of India, the colonial government at that time, the British colonial government, and she said, "I want to begin a medical school." And of course they said to her, "Of course you do, little lady. Girls can't learn to be doctors." She said, "Well, I know that. That's true. I understand where you're coming from. But what if I did train them? And what if they took the test? And what if they passed?" The government official said, "Sure. What if you do? And what if they do? And what if they can? No problem." 4 years later, the first cadre of Ida's graduates, more than 24 of them, took the Indian National Medical Exam, and there was a problem. They threw off the curve. Because Ida's women physicians scored so high on the exam, the bell curve was disrupted, and all of the men who had studied to be doctors that year barely passed. Every single one of hers were at the top. And they went back, and there were new beds, and the hospital grew and continued to grow. And today, for the equivalent of $60 per year, young women continue to train as physicians and to serve not only in India but around the world as top-flight healthcare providers. They also have pharmacists and nurses and technicians all learning in that place, all because of one person who understood that it's not about, "Are you my neighbor?" It's about, "Will I be a neighbor? Even if it requires effort, even if it requires risk, even when it requires faith and commitment and hope and courage." We live in a world, and it seems that we live in a moment in time where people are trying to wall out neighbors, where people are afraid of what neighbors might or might not do. We as Christian people are called to be neighbors. I visited several Hindu temples when I was in southern India, and outside one of the Hindu temples, as I was removing my shoes so that I could go in, a Hindu man came over to me and said, "Excuse me, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from the United States, from St. Louis." And he said, "Well, my children would love to meet you." Took my hand and walked me over, and not only were his children there, but his brother and his sister-in-law and his father and his mother and their children. It was a group of about 25 people, and they all wanted to meet. They wanted to say, "Welcome to India. Why are you here?" I said, "Well, I'm a Christian pastor, and I'm here for continuing education, and I'm visiting some mission places." And they said, "Oh, that's so wonderful. We're glad you're here. Please tell people when you go home about our culture and the welcome you experienced here." I got some pictures with them. I'll show them to you in the next couple of weeks. But what they wanted me to know was, just because you're from across a border, just because your skin doesn't look like ours, just because your first language is not the same as ours, just because we're from different religious traditions, doesn't mean we can't be neighbors. It doesn't mean I can't welcome you. It doesn't mean you're not another beloved human being. It also happened in Qatar when I was there at the airport for several hours with Muslims, Arabs, reaching out to me, welcoming me, asking me if I was okay, taking care of me. It happened each and every place. People risking themselves to care for the stranger. It can happen here. It's called to happen here. It ought to happen here. This week, this month, this year, how will we extend ourselves? How will we, instead of asking, is that person my neighbor, get busy about being a neighbor? The beauty of it is this. Jesus says, not only are you called to be a neighbor, but you are empowered by God's Holy Spirit to do the work that neighbors do. And the thing is, when we enact neighborliness, when we reach out to others, when we ignore boundaries and embrace other people, the world broadens, compassion deepens, and relationships grow. Yes, it's risky. But remember, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us, the question is not, what will happen to me if I help? The question is, what will happen to them if I don't? And even more broadly, what will happen to the world if we become those who ignore neighbors and refuse to help and refuse to welcome? The biblical answer is this. The world will become a smaller, colder, darker place, and will somehow lose touch with God's love and grace. What will happen if we embrace the neighbor? What will happen if we serve the neighbor? What will happen if we welcome the neighbor? What will happen if we love the neighbor? Our eyes will open, as well as our hearts. Our arms will be strengthened. Our friendships will grow. Our networks will continue to expand. And the kingdom of God, as Jesus said at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, will indeed be at hand. For truly, neighbor is as neighbor does. Go and do likewise. Amen.